Hello, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm head of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I'd like to welcome you to the next in our series of chats, of web chats, with people who we think have something interesting to say about drugs and drug policy. You've heard me talk with Ram Dass and with Ira Glasser, the former head of the ACLU, and with Eric Schlosser, who wrote Reefer Madness. And I have to say, I am incredibly happy to have the guests that we're going to have for the next hour, who is Dr. Andrew Weil. Andy Weil has now, of course, become famous for his writing on integrative medicine, for the integration of Western medicine and alternative medicine. But before he became famous in that way, he was well known to many of us as really one of the leading thinkers about drugs and why people use drugs, why people get in trouble with drugs. His books, The Natural Mind, and then From Chocolate to Morphine, which he wrote with Winifred Rosen, and also The Marriage of the Sun and the Moon, all of those, he took time off from writing about his integrative medicine to take those three books and update and revise them, and they are now back out and available. In fact, you can order them by going to the webpage, the front page of the Drug Policy Alliance website. So, Andy, thank you very, very much for being on. I'm really glad that you're here with us.
Hi, Ethan. I'm delighted to be here.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I remember we go back, I think, to 1987 when I was teaching at Princeton and invited you to come.
Yeah,
give a talk there, and you were just beginning to write about the health and healing stuff. You know, one of the things I remember that you surprised many of us. I invited you to talk about drugs. I thought you were going to talk about marijuana and, you know, cocaine and all this. And you landed up spending half your time talking about coffee and chocolate, right? And about how those things were drugs in many more ways than people appreciated, in both good and bad ways. And I wonder if you could say a little something about that.
Well, you know, in The Natural Mind, one of the main points that I made was to ask people to look at the universality of drug use. You know, all human cultures have been heavily involved with drugs. Usually one or two or a small number of drugs are approved and their use is encouraged, and all the rest are discouraged and banned. And I think we tend to be very dishonest about the drugs that we use ourselves and that we consider to be good things, that we promote, make money off of, and so forth. So I've always found it useful to direct people's attention to, you know, those drugs that we live with, which are alcohol, tobacco, and caffeine in its various forms. The caffeine plants, I think, in particular, are useful to look at because they're the most unconsciously used drugs that many people who use them, even people who are addicted to them, have no sense that they're involved with drugs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, it's one of the things about caffeine. I mean, it raises the issue of what sorts of stimulants a society can live with, what it can choose to live with, right? I mean, we live in this world where millions of teenagers, especially boys, are being prescribed Ritalin and Adderall-type drugs, and where, you know, caffeine seems to be in everything. And then meanwhile, you know, there's this drug cocaine, which is highly demonized. But you did a lot of work with cocaine and with coca. And I remember some stuff you're writing saying, you know, maybe that's a drug that might have a much better place in our society.
Well, I was specifically writing about coca leaf, the natural source of cocaine, and I studied its use in Indian populations. And I think for those people, it combines the functions of coffee and chewing gum in our culture. It's their main social recreational drug and useful stimulant and medicinal plant, and it's considered a sacred substance, very well integrated into their society. And I, for a number of years, tried to see if there were ways of making coca available up here, because I thought it could be a useful, valuable plant, and that it might actually offset some of the demand for cocaine.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I remember there was a piece you wrote, was it the Journal of Ethnopharmacology, I think, and where you talked about the potential medicinal value of coca?
Yeah, actually, coca has some very unique effects in stabilizing blood sugar. I think it could be, I could see a lot of ways that it could be used in our medicine. It has a low abuse potential, and for me, it provides a very good model of how you go wrong in approaching drug plants. You know, nature provides us with all sorts of plants that have effects, stimulants, depressants, psychedelics, and that I think the history of human beings and coca and cocaine is a real cautionary tale of what not to do. You know, we went into these cultures, immediately decided that this was an evil plant, tried to stamp it out, and that didn't work, and then we isolated cocaine from the plant and flooded the world with that in the belief that it was the only thing of interest in coca. You know, we've now got this terrific problem with cocaine and see the plant as being the source of all the problem when, in fact, it's our really misunderstanding of the nature of that plant and its relationship with that molecule.
Yeah, well, because, you know, one of the things, you know, the U.S. government for decades now has been spending, I mean, literally billions of dollars and getting other governments to do the same to try to eradicate coca from the face of the earth, especially from the face of the South American earth.
Yeah.
Here's a plant that's been there for thousands of years. And the whole idea is to try to reduce cocaine abuse. Now, if you pick up the New York Times today or look at the AP Wire stories or Financial Times, you know, all of a sudden Colombian cocaine's in the news because Condoleezza Rice, the Secretary of State, is in Colombia today and yesterday, and they're praising the Colombian government for their efforts about eradicating all this cocaine and such. And meanwhile, of course, the price of cocaine and availability in cocaine are just the same. In fact, it may be the price is going down and the availability is going up. Now, one of the ideas which the Bolivians and the Peruvians, at least some of them, have pushed for many years is to say, look, as you're saying, Andy, coca tea, coca tonics, these things, they're available in our society. I mean, they don't have the sophistication of the multinationals in making these things. But what about opening up what existed 100 years ago in terms
of
international
my feeling
markets?
Was always that if you could find legitimate uses for coca and develop markets for that, it would take a lot of this pressure off, that there then would be some legal exports of coca. You would halt some of the diversion to black markets. And in addition, you could really try to educate people about why, you know, if you want to be involved with that plant and if you want to take a natural stimulant, it is much, much more sensible to take the leaf in some whole form rather than to take this extracted alkaloid.
Well, what about a chewing gum?
That was the idea that I had. It seemed to me that if you could make a coca gum, that it would most closely reproduce the way that Indians used it. And the advantages of a gum are that it puts the drug in your system slowly. I thought this could be very useful, for example, as a weight loss aid or as an aid to physical activity. It's very useful as a stomach remedy. That's the main indication for it in Andean folk medicine. It may be useful in preventing type 2 diabetes in people who are prone to that. And there are a lot of potential medicinal uses of it. I think that there, as I said, if it were available, I would certainly recommend it to people.
Yeah. Well, you see, now, one of the questions that came in was from Linda Green, and she asked if parents, do you think that parents are aware that many drugs for ADHD are a form of amphetamine?
I have a feeling many of them aren't. I you know, one of the commonest drugs used now is Adderall, which is dexedrine, and this, you know, I find a lot of people are very surprised to hear that this is speed.
Mm-hmm.
And this has really been supplanted Ritalin, so we're back to using, you know, a very powerful form of amphetamine in kids. It's widely prescribed, and I think many people have no idea that.
I mean, is Ritalin and Adderall that much different, or are they basically both?
Dexedrine is a little stronger than Ritalin, and I think the abuse potential of it is higher. I think it's a bit different.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we'll inevitably land up in our discussion going back and forth between, you know, your talking and writing about the illicit drugs and that stuff and your more recent stuff. And obviously so much of what's on people's minds now when you talk about drugs in society, a lot of it's about, you know, the stuff that's quasi-legal. It's the Prozacs and the Viagras and the Ritalins and the Adderalls. And I wonder, with something like, I mean, here's millions of teenage kids, right, being diagnosed with, you know, ADD or ADHD and being prescribed these substances. Speaking from your more modern perspective, your more current work, what would you be recommending in these situations?
I think there's no question that there's a subset of these kids who do well on the drugs, but it may be a fairly small percentage. For many of them, I think there are alternative treatments available, everything from giving them fish oil supplements to modifying their diets to using homeopathy or and then I think for some of them, there's a real question about the nature of the diagnosis. It may be that these kids just aren't suited to the conventional school framework and that they should be in a different kind of learning environment. But I think this universal response of giving strong stimulants to every kid who doesn't pay attention is not very wise, and I think we're going to get ourselves in some trouble as a result of doing that.
Yeah. Well, I have to say, I mean, one of the things that really struck me in reading a lot of your writing, Andy, was that you come up with the idea that what this country or what modern society really needs, and tell me if you agree with this or not, you know, is really a good, safe stimulant, and that coffee plays a certain role in caffeine. But in point of fact, and we're giving, putting tens of millions or millions of people on the Dexedrines and the Ritalins and whatever, but that, you know, we really need to be looking for something better. What do you think?
Well, I think there's always going to be a need for stimulants, whether it's people driving long distances or people that have to stay up to do shift work or students who are studying. I think stimulants have their place, and ideally a stimulant should not have harmful effects on the body. People should be aware of its risk for dependence and so forth. I'm certainly in favor of better stimulants rather than worse stimulants. Ephedra, which was caused all this controversy last year, is not a particularly good stimulant in my experience. It causes a lot of anxiety and jitteriness. I don't think it's a bad plant. I think the problems we saw with it were the result of really bad manufacturing practices of packaging it in too high dosage and combining it with caffeine and other stimulants. But I don't think it's a great stimulant. I think coca is a much better one.
Yeah, wasn't it something called like Mormon tea or something like that? Which
Mormon
is
tea is American ephedra, widely used in this country over the past couple of centuries. It doesn't have a lot of ephedrine in it. The Chinese variety is the main source.
Mm-hmm. Now let me jump to another subject, which has also been in the news a bit, which is the whole issue of treating pain. I mean, obviously, chronic pain, severe pain, is something which millions, if not tens of millions, of Americans suffer with every day. Some people listening to this chat may be familiar with the case of William Hurwitz, Dr. Hurwitz, the pain doctor, who was convicted of, drug dealing because he was aggressively providing pain medications, opioid medications, to people dealing with serious pain. What's your view about this? I mean, are we dealing with an issue of the underutilization or the overutilization or the
possibly both at the same time? Chronic pain is a very tough problem, and many doctors don't like to deal with chronic pain patients. They're difficult.
Mm-hmm.
There are alternative methods of dealing with chronic pain, everything from acupuncture to hypnosis, for example. I think that for for certain kinds of chronic pain, the pain associated with cancer, advanced cancer, for example, there is no reason to withhold opiates, and that often they are underutilized. There's no reason why patients with advanced cancer should be in a great deal of pain at the end of life. On the other hand, I think there's tremendous overprescribing of pain medication, and without considering alternatives. We're just now also have seen all this publicity about the adverse effects of non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs for pain. So I think, in general, I think our prescribing practices are not great, and that a lot of this comes down to the fact that physicians are not really very well trained in the use of mind-altering substances.
Mm-hmm. Andy, I mean, this is almost a little off-subject for the whole thing, but one of the ways in which, you and I interacted that was not in a purely professional way was when you were briefly sort of my doctor when I went through this very horrible experience with back pain, which I think you wrote about.
I wrote that up in Spontaneous Healing.
Spontaneous Healing. And one of the things that what I realized was there I was on very substantial painkillers, and it didn't seem to be numbing the pain at all. And you recommended I read a book and see a doctor named Sarno, who made a persuasive case that all of these things about herniated discs and such were, not about disabilities in the body, not about physical disabilities. They were about psychological processes going on. And that turned out to be a miracle cure for me.
Right.
But it made me wonder that maybe part of the problem when you say we both have an over-prescribing and under-prescribing is that what's happening is millions of people are being prescribed these opiate drugs for problems which aren't like cancer pain, which are profoundly painful, but where the cause is really, I don't know if psychosomatic is the word, or what would you say?
Well, I'd say it's a mind-body problem.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think this is certainly true for the majority of cases of back pain, that it is a mind-body problem and it's best approached through some sort of mind-body therapy rather than a purely body-oriented approach or a pharmacological approach. And I guess, as again, I said, I think this comes down to the fact that we need better education, both of patients and of physicians, about the nature of pain and the ways of managing it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm going to stop for 1 second just to say, for those of you who have tuned in the last few minutes, this is Ethan Adelman. I'm the director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I'm speaking today with Dr. Andrew Weil, who has written some of the really path-breaking books about drugs and drug policy and drug education, and who is also, you know, going to be, Andy, tell me, you're coming out with a book later on this fall?
I have a book called Healthy Aging, which is, and that's what it's about. It's about maintaining optimum health as you get older. It'll be published by Knopf in October of this year.
You say anything about drugs in that book?
I do. I talk about you know, drugs that have been recommended as beneficial to brain health, and talk about some of the drugs that are used habitually. But, you know, I've written plenty about drugs, Ethan, as you know,
yeah.
And I think all that information is out there in the various books that I've written.
Yeah. Well, you know, as you can imagine, a lot of the questions coming in are about marijuana.
Yeah.
Right? And, I mean, one, of course, is about medical marijuana.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you can maybe just say a word about that.
Sure.
But then the other question is, you know, you were just mentioning before we got on about the new marijuana extract spray that GW Pharmaceutical got permission to sell in Canada.
Yeah,
I
think the great advantage of marijuana as a medical drug is that it is so non-toxic, much less so than almost anything we use in the way of pharmaceuticals. The disadvantages of it are that there's a lot of individual variation in response to it, and taking a drug in the form of inhaled smoke is not ideal. And I think for physicians, a practical problem is that, you know, they may be reluctant to recommend something that people have to smoke. And the other problem for them is, I think that smoking marijuana and the way medical marijuana is currently being distributed in some states through buying clubs doesn't really cleanly distinguish the medical use from the recreational use. So one of the reasons that I've been enthusiastic about this product called Sativex, it was developed in England. First of all, it's a whole extract of marijuana. It's not a piece of marijuana like Marinol. And it's the whole plant. And it's in a form, a spray to be sprayed in the mouth under the tongue, which is more like a medical drug than a cigarette. So I think that if that were available here, more physicians would be more comfortable with recommending marijuana to patients.
That question I just asked you, by the way, came from Mitch Earlywine, who's a professor at University of Southern California, about to move to Albany, and who wrote the book Understanding Marijuana, which is probably, together with the book by Lynn Zimmer and John Morgan, Marijuana, Miss Marijuana Facts, I'd say that those two books, Marijuana, Miss Marijuana Facts, and Mitch's Understanding Marijuana, are probably the two best books out there today.
Uh-huh.
And I know they both draw a lot on your way of thinking about this stuff. Now, there's a question here, a very specific one from Bruce, who's asking about what's the impact of marijuana on the liver, particularly on a liver compromised by the Hep C virus.
You know, marijuana has a very minimal impact on the liver. So for people who have liver disease, it's probably one of the less risky drugs to use.
Okay.
And day and night difference from a drug like alcohol, which has a very strong impact on the liver.
Okay. Now, Vicky Hedke asks, I find that cannabis seems to help with arthritis pain and sometimes insomnia. Is this just wishful thinking on my part, or is it the placebo effect?
Well, I think it's individual reaction. You know, what I've written about in the past is that marijuana seems to treat people rather than conditions. So if a person responds to marijuana favorably, that person may be able to use it for a variety of health conditions. So she may have a good response to marijuana and therefore is able to use it.
Now, there's another question here from Dr. Tim Cermak, who wrote a book about marijuana. And in fact, Andy, you may be interested. Last week, Marcia Rosenbaum organized a seminar at the San Francisco Medical Society on 420, appropriate day, about marijuana. And I was on the panel, and Mitch Earlywine, and also Tim Cermak, and he writes here, "I was fascinated, Andy, by your description years ago of marijuana as an active placebo. You've continued to use this description in recent editions as well. However, given research findings about the pervasive endocannabinoid system, how can you continue to call marijuana a quote-unquote active placebo?"
Well, the activity of marijuana, certainly may be in its binding to receptors in the brain and causing changes in the way in perception, for example. I still think that the marijuana high is something that one has to learn to associate with those pharmacological changes. And that's what I meant by an active placebo. That is that the drug is doing something. You know, it's having a real effect on brain and changing levels of activation and ways of perception, but that's not the high. The high is something that we can feel in all sorts of circumstances, and you have to make a learned association to those pharmacological effects.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeff Noller says, "I just reread the piece that you and Norman Zinberg wrote years ago for the marijuana papers. In light of current knowledge regarding the harms and increased potency of contemporary cannabis, have you changed your opinion at all about the innocuous nature of cannabis?"
Not really. I think it is still relatively innocuous compared to other substances out there. And my impression is, first of all, that if people use any form of cannabis regularly, they grow tolerant to the effects of it, and that novice users will simply use less of the stronger form. So, no, I think it is still a relatively benign drug compared to the other psychoactive substances that are out there.
Okay, well, here's a sort of related question. Mark Hayek says, since he's read that the brain produces cannabinoids naturally for stress relief and other uses, including preventing Alzheimer's, is it relatively safe and beneficial, say, cannabis in moderation as a natural sedative compared to, say, alcohol?
Well, there's it's an interesting change in the past, I would say, year particularly, to begin seeing reports in the medical literature of beneficial effects of cannabis. This was simply off limits before. Now, whether that researchers weren't looking for it or journals wouldn't publish it, we just didn't see it. And now there's actually a number of things coming out about the possible preventive effects for various forms of cancer, Alzheimer's disease, and so forth. I would keep an eye on that literature. It's just interesting to look at. In terms of an individual's choice of a relaxant, I think that it really depends on how frequently you're going to use something. Marijuana is a much less powerful pharmacological agent than alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Now, on the other hand, is it fair to say that for some people, though, alcohol is easier to control, and that for older people, the drink or two a day is beneficial for one's health? And
I think there are many people that don't like the effects of marijuana. I think there are disadvantages, as I've said, to smoking something rather than ingesting. Mm-hmm. There certainly is a literature on the health benefits of alcohol, which both have to do with relaxant effects and with beneficial effects on blood lipids, and in the case of red wine, with effects due to the antioxidant pigments in red wine.
Mm-hmm. Andy, going back to what you're saying too, I remember back in the mid-90s, we both had been quite friendly with Lester Grinspoon, and
yes,
his book on marijuana back in the 70s, I think, really was the best book day on it.
Yeah.
And I think it was Marijuana Reconsidered.
Right.
And Lester started talking about marijuana really being the new aspirin.
Yes.
And I'm going, okay, Lester, aren't you going a bit far here? And then The Lancet comes out, the leading British medical journal a few years ago, with an editorial saying maybe the same thing. And now, as you're saying, here's these reports, isn't it unusual that they can't find a single case of lung cancer involving marijuana only, and these tests with rats and other animals showing reduced levels of other types of cancers, although slightly increased risk at a few? What do you think? Is the basic cannabinoids and the substances, is Lester potentially right about this?
Well, I think clearly there is a beneficial side to the cannabinoids. And, I think, as with most things that in this realm, that there are pluses and minuses to the regular use of a drug like marijuana. But I think in this culture there has been an enormous reluctance to admit the benefits of that drug. And now, you know, possibly as a result of cultural changes, we're beginning to see some reports on this.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you would agree with what we're doing, which is that basically, you know, whatever the risks and harms of marijuana, the risks and harms of treating it as a criminal substance and arresting and hurting people for this far outweigh any potential risks.
Well, as you know, I strongly agree with that, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, I've been a major supporter of the Drug Policy Institute over the years. I think you're doing great work there.
Oh, thanks. No, I appreciate it. That's a nice lead-in for me to say. For those of you who just turned in, this is Ethan Nadelman. I'm head of the Drug Policy Alliance, which is the country's leading organization promoting alternatives to the war on drugs. I'm speaking with Andy Weil, the distinguished writer and medical expert about drugs and a whole range of other subjects. But I should also just say right here that we are a membership organization. You know, if you're not signed up on our email list, please go to our website, drugpolicy.org, right on the homepage where you are right now, and sign up for our bi-monthly e-newsletter, and please also sign up for action alerts, because the only way the politics in this country around drug policy are going to change is if you and as many people as possible really get involved. And also, although we do get significant support from a small number of wealthy people and some foundations, ultimately, this is a membership organization, and whatever you can contribute, you know, your contributions go to support this web chat, they go to support our efforts to make marijuana legal for medical purposes around the country, they go to support the litigation to protect patients and providers and caretakers, they go to reform the Rockefeller drug laws and to prevent AIDS and hepatitis and what more through harm reduction policies. So if you haven't contributed to the organization or signed up as a member, please do that. Okay, Andy, we're back on another subject, and this is one that we've really been struggling with at the Drug Policy Alliance. Mm-hmm. You know, the issue of drug testing kids, there's this big push for drug testing kids. And President Bush, when he had his State of the Union address a year and a half ago, the only thing he said about drugs, really, were about steroids and then about let's drug test the kids. And we've been very firm that drug testing kids, random drug testing, does more harm than good. It's, you know, it pushes kids away from extracurriculars. It catches them for the wrong drugs, all this sort of thing. But now, with all of this stuff in the papers about steroids, and we're struggling with this issue. We think the same principles apply, but there is this issue in sports, and it's not psychoactive in the same way that marijuana or alcohol or ecstasy is. I mean, what do you think about this steroid situation? What's the best way to deal with this? Is this another drug craze going on? What do you think?
I think the dangers are exaggerated here. I don't think it's healthy to be on anabolic steroids long term, and I would certainly discourage people from doing that, especially young people. I think that, you know, what you're really, you know, the real concern is performance. So I think, you know, in athletics, the concern is about an unfair edge in performance competition. So I think the testing originally started as a way of screening out athletes who were getting unfair advantage from using substances. Now, extending that to kids, I don't know. I mean, I think this gets into territory that's difficult, and certainly in line with what your attitude has been toward the use of recreational drugs. You know, by the way, anabolic steroids are not without psychoactive effect. They can make people euphoric, they can make people depressed, they can make people aggressive, but they certainly have effects on mood.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're now also reading about people getting off them suddenly, and that seems to be where some of the suicides are coming. Is that correct?
Yeah.
That the sudden withdrawal is part of the risk.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, that there's this kind of concern. There is this rampant drugging of kids with psychiatric medications, which is of great concern to me.
Yeah,
you know, I don't think it's that healthy to have such a high percentage of kids in this country on psychiatric drugs, often multiple drugs.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's also, though, I mean, you have this stuff, I mean, whether it's Schwarzenegger, the governor of California, or Jose Canseco, the baseball player, others, I mean, there's also people out there saying, hey, wait a second, there are safe ways to use steroids, and there are dangerous ways to use them, just like with any other drug. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that's certainly true of adults, are saying, and maybe it's even true of younger people, and let's not demonize the whole use of this. you know, because people are using it in dumb and stupid and unsupervised ways, and that we actually need to bring this more above board, not the other. Now, I'm not exactly sure that's how I feel, but I'm wondering, is that a correct perspective, do you think?
I don't know either. I don't know what the right thing is here. Are there correct uses of steroid drugs? I think that they're a class of drugs that have significant potential for long-term harm on physical health. I think people should certainly be aware of that. They can interfere with growth and development. They can affect the general hormonal metabolism of the body. I would certainly try to discourage any young person that I knew from using them.
But if they were insistent, if they were insistent, or if they were involved, and let's take aside the ethical issue of getting an unfair advantage in a competition, but let's say this was about bodybuilding, it was, or it was about.
Yeah, but why would you want to do that? It seems to me that that's.
Well, one can say that about anything, but let's
assume
that, you know, that you have somebody who, you know, because I like the way they make me feel. I like the way the ease with which it helps me build muscle. I like whatever. It makes me feel better. But I don't want to hurt myself. I want to do whatever cycling and whatever dosing is appropriate so I can get to benefit and minimize the harm. And that's, I mean, I don't know this issue because it's not about the psychoactive drugs.
Yeah, well,
really
I guess you could make an argument that then if people are going to use them, that your goal here, as with the recreational drugs, should be harm reduction, and that means giving people as much information as you can about ways to protect themselves from the downside of them.
Yeah, no, I don't know. You know, it's interesting because I realize this goes beyond the medical issue, but if you look at this whole issue now with steroid testing and, you know, and how it relates to the issue of competition and whether it's an unfair advantage.
Yep.
And in the sports area, you have people saying, well, look, I mean, there's all sorts of other ways in which people get unfair advantages, some of which are legal or permissible. You know, wealthier people have access to better equipment that saves this, or they have access to better doctors and better legitimate supplements.
Uh-huh.
And then you start to look at all the Ritalins and Adderalls and all of the reports that kids are using these things basically to do better on tests, because of good evidence that they help that, you know. And then you find that, you know, obviously if you come from the right family that's connected, anybody can get their kid a prescription for this. And we know that almost anybody will be helped in the moment by a stimulant drug.
Right.
And I wonder if we're actually, as a result, going to be moving towards a society in which everybody is being tested, or if, in point of fact, the whole notion of performance enhancing, this is and that, is for mental, for memory, for physical performance, what have you, is going to become so pervasive that it will become normalized in our society. I mean, when you think ahead, Andy, like, I mean, you know, think ahead another generation, right? Think ahead to our kids and our grandkids and such, right? What do you think is going to be the story?
I think lots of people are going to be using lots of drugs.
Yeah. And should we rely on the pharmaceutical companies to be the, you know, the nayers and the sayers about what's going to be available?
You ask hard questions, Ethan.
You know, well, I mean, it's, you know, it's an interesting question, because the pharmaceutical companies are obviously, they go through the testing processes, but on the other hand, they have their own interests, and we see them getting in trouble for putting stuff out there too fast.
Right.
You know, and, I mean, I guess part of it is that underlying it all is somehow a notion that, you know, we're all somehow born as perfectly balanced chemical creatures and that we shouldn't use drugs, and yet it turns out that we're not all that way and that drugs can both help us and get us in trouble. And
so my approach has always been to try to give people the best possible information about drugs, about both their risks and benefits, so that they can make informed decisions about them, and if they do decide to use them, to use them in ways that are going to produce the least harm.
Yeah, no, it does seem that what we need is almost like a consumer's report, you know, backed by an informed National Academy of Science website or something.
Yep.
So that, I mean, where do, in fact, doctors find out their money, their information about drugs?
Well, as you know, most of them get the information from the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
And not from objective sources.
Yeah. Yeah, now on your website, right, AskDrWeil.com, is that it?
It's DrWeil.com, DrWeil.com.
And that has pretty good information about a lot of these things.
I think it has very good information, and one of the things that we try to do is to always give links. links to other sites so people don't just get my view, but they get some balanced views on a subject.
Yeah, I know sometimes people have asked what's the best site on the psychedelics, and the one that I've heard recommended is Arrowhead.
Yes, I have used that. I find that to be very useful.
Yeah, are there others that you would recommend out there?
That's really the only one that I know of.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'll tell you something else. Your book, Chocolate to Morphine, I guess it's now in the third edition, but there is absolutely no better book out there for drug education with either kids or adults. I mean, you start off with this clear message. Well, why don't you say what you were trying to do in that book?
Well, I mean, the idea was to give very straight, unbiased information about drugs, not really emphasizing either benefits or dangers and not trying to make drugs attractive or unattractive, but just so that people could make intelligent decisions about them. And I've gotten very gratifying feedback about that book over the years, and I'm delighted that the publisher wanted to reissue it in a new edition. It's been very thoroughly revised and updated.
Yeah, although I also remember you had some feedback. What was it, the former senator from Florida?
Well, the book was published in 1983, in the year that the war on drugs began in its present form. And so it was kind of an inopportune moment. And yes, there was a Senator Paula Hawkins from Florida who made it as one of her campaign issues to get the book banned from libraries and other public places.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I mean, Marsha Rosenbaum, who directs our Safety First project, which is our project for parents and teens involving drug abuse prevention. And, you know, it's basically a sex education, a comprehensive sex education model applied to drug education,
yep,
which has now been endorsed by the California PTA, and which we're increasingly taking national. In fact, I think Marsha's at the PTA's conference in Sacramento as we speak.
Oh, great.
But I'll tell you, it's your book that she is that she's hawking out there all the time as the one that the PTA needs to embrace at this time.
Yeah.
And I really think that if we had that book out there, there'd be a lot fewer problems and a lot less fear.
Okay.
About teenagers being out there with drugs.
Uh-huh.
So listen, now there's a few questions here about addiction.
Yeah.
And treating addiction. Linda Jordan from North Vancouver in British Columbia, she asked, what natural products, vitamins, minerals are there that could be helping a recovering, relapsing drug addict? With detox kits that help to cleanse the body, what about specific vitamins or minerals, et cetera?
You know, I don't think there are any natural products that specifically help the addictive process. However, I feel very strongly that if somebody is trying to recover from addiction, it's important to really work on all fronts to improve general health. And that means having good habits of nutrition, exercise, rest, sleep, stress reduction, and so forth. And as part of that, I think using dietary supplements wisely, I would certainly take a good multivitamin, multi-mineral product, there are natural relaxant herbs like valerian that can be helpful for sleep. Acupuncture can be very helpful in addiction recovery. I think learning stress reduction, relaxation methods like breathing exercises or practicing yoga can be extremely beneficial. Hypnosis can be beneficial. But I don't think there are, you know, there's no magic herbs for stimulating recovery from addiction.
Mm-hmm. Andy, let's talk a little bit about ecstasy.
Yes.
MDMA, you know, which now millions and millions of people have used. You know, some use it in a sort of intimate situation with friends or a lover, and some of it's by younger people going to raves and such. And, I mean, what's your current sense about the risks of this and about the benefits?
I think if it's used in reasonable dosages, you know, in the range of 125 milligrams, and people take it, do sensible things when they're on it, I think it's very low risk.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only problems that I've seen have been people taking way too much or combining it with other drugs or taking it at raves where they dance in enclosed spaces and don't drink water and get overheated. I do not believe the neurological scares about it. I think that this was really faulty research. And I think it's really fundamentally not different from the stimulants that it's related to, from methamphetamine, for example.
Mm-hmm. Now, it also seems to be a drug which almost more than any other one, for many people, they develop a very rapid tolerance. You know, there's a whole lore that the first experience or one of the first two or three are the best ever, mm-hmm. that you're never going to hit that peak, and that for many people, after they've done it 10 or 20 times over a few years, you know, there's not that much upside and a growing downside. And I wonder, what's your sense about, I mean, do you think that's right, and why does that happen?
I see that in some people. I don't see it in others. I've known other people that have used it over 30 or 40 years, taking it at long intervals, and say the experience with it have been just as satisfying for them. So I think that's an individual variation.
And there's also stuff out there about things, supplements, and ways to do it and such that maybe can enable people to keep getting the upsides without getting the downsides.
I think the main way to do that is to space out the frequency at which you do it. I think the less frequently you do it, the better the experience is. That's the bottom line.
Now, another drug that became popular in the clubs for a while was GHB. I mean,
yes.
Can you tell us a little something about that?
Well, this is an odd one. It's a natural product. It's actually made in the brain. It's an it's an analog of one of the sedative brain neurotransmitters. It was being marketed for a while as a growth hormone releaser to bodybuilders. But if taken in its relatively large quantities, it causes a kind of alcohol-like intoxication without the mental clouding effect of alcohol. So a kind of rubbery feeling in the body, dreamy state that most people perceive as pleasant. I think the main danger that I've seen of it is that in too high dosage, it can interfere with breathing. And, that can be scary, that people, look as if they stop breathing for a while. I don't hear much about it lately. I think the other problem is, obviously it's not a good one to combine with alcohol or other sedatives or to drive while you're under the influence because it makes you uncoordinated.
Yeah, I don't know if it's as popular. I mean, that may have been passing a bit. Now, just to go back to the stimulants again for a second where we started, it seems now that the new drug craze in big parts of America, not so much the East Coast, but throughout the middle part of the country as well as Hawaii and parts of California, is methamphetamine.
Well, that's been around for a while, and, in various forms. It's relatively easy to make, and there are, I think the thing that's very surprising is hearing about the amount of production in rural areas of the country, where you just wouldn't expect it. Southern Idaho, for example, Wyoming. It seems to be widely used. It's often smoked as well, or snorted, as well as taken by mouth. I think, methamphetamine is not fundamentally different from dexedrine or plain old amphetamine. I mean, these are all significant stimulants, and if they're used intelligently, meaning in reasonable dosages and not too frequently and put into the body and, preferably by mouth rather than by other routes, I think one can use these. And I mean, this is, after all, what a lot of students are doing is taking Adderall. It's basically the same drug. So I think the problems that we see with it today have to do with why people are using it, how much they're taking, the ways they're introducing it in the body, and what they might be combining it with.
Well, it's interesting because, in speaking with some folks I know who are sort of in the whole, gay party scene, and this is a party scene where, these are drug-experienced guys. I mean, they have, marijuana, sure, and cocaine, and ketamine, and GHB, and ecstasy, and they got it all under control. And then they meet methamphetamine, and methamphetamine seems to be the drug to which many of them are succumbing in a way they did not experience with anything else.
I'm surprised. I think in my experience, cocaine has certainly has much potential for that. The problem, again, is that with these things, if you start using them frequently, especially if you're snorting them or smoking them, the tolerance is very rapid. And what you mentioned about ecstasy, really happens with these drugs, but it happens over a very short space of time. So you keep looking for that, initial high of the day or evening, and it's fading, and you take more and more of the drug, and you get more and more of the adverse effects. If you go on a run with methamphetamine, it's not very pleasant. It can really make people crazy, and it can leave you quite depleted, and it's not a good pattern. It can really interfere with lifestyle and with healthy habits.
Well, now, you know, our culture, more than almost any other, has been so obsessed, really, with abstinence as the only way, especially if you've had a problem with drugs.
Right.
And, you know, it was very fortunate that 30, 40 years ago, you know, Vincent Dole and Marie Niswander figured out that methadone was an effective way of dealing with illicit heroin addiction, right? It was a way of stabilizing and maintaining the opiate use, but removing the, you know, change, transforming essentially an addiction into a dependence. And we see some of that, of course, also happening with nicotine patches and chewing gums and cigarettes. Now, the question is with the stimulants. How much can we say that that might be a possibility? That maybe for folks who have lost control with cocaine or with methamphetamine, you know, and the standard American approach, right, almost the only American approach, is then to say abstinence is it. That's all we're going to accept. Or maybe we'll let you smoke cigarettes. And what about this notion of the lower potency stimulant drugs being a way, not that it would work pharmacologically like methadone, but might
again
help.
If we had coca chewing gum available, I think there would be a great use for it.
And you think
teach
you
people
work
how to satisfy
people.
Their stimulant needs.
Yeah, you think that might work.
I think it might work.
It's interesting. You only wish people would be thinking about trying that. Let me take a little break here. This is Ethan Nadelman. I am the head of the Drug Policy Alliance, which is the leading organization in the country of people who believe the war on drugs is doing more harm than good. We're a national membership organization with offices in New York, New Jersey, New Mexico, California, and D.C. We hope that you will choose to support this organization on our website, sign up for our e-newsletters and our action alerts, and make a contribution to support our work, be active how best you can, and also, you know, go on the website and buy the recently revised and issued editions of Andy Weil's three books on drugs, The Natural Mind, Chocolate to Morphine, and The Marriage of the Sun and the Moon. So my guest is Dr. Andrew Weil, and we're going to approach the last quarter of this web chat. Andy, let me throw a few ones now that go more to some of the issues about you and your origins in this stuff. You know, when I read The Natural Mind, and I know so many people feel this way, it was like reading a book which just seemed somehow, for many of us who thought that the current way of thinking was not right and thought we were beginning to figure out an alternative that made sense, reading your book was like saying, oh my God, here's this guy who's thought of all this already, and he's taken it the next 3, 4, and 5 steps. Yeah. And I remember especially the notion that for many people, if not all people, that the desire to alter one's state of consciousness is an innate human desire. You analogize it to kids spinning around when they're 5 or 6, makes them dizzy. And I wonder, how do you feel about that formulation now, 30 years after the original writing? And secondly, how has that informed the work that you're now doing on integrative medicine?
Well, when I set out to revise The Natural Mind to get a new edition of it out last year, I mean, this is the first time that I went through the book with an eye to revising it and updating it to see if any changes were necessary. And I found that, you know, certain things in it were dated, but that the fundamental ideas, I think, are all very sound, and I stick by them, and I've seen nothing in my experience that would lead me to change them. You know, I still very much believe that the desire to alter consciousness is a fundamental human drive, that drugs are one way of satisfying it, that the highs really come from within, and one learns to associate them with drug effects. So I think all those basic ideas, I see no need to change. They're, I think, as valid now as they were when I wrote the book 30 years ago. In terms of the relevance of that to my current work, I think there's a very close analogy in that in my writings about health and healing, the main point has been that healing is something that's innate, that it's inside the body, that it can be activated or released by various external treatments, but that basically it's something inside. So I think that's an extension or generalization of what I saw with regard to highs and drugs. And, you know, there have been times in the past few years when I've gone on talk shows or been interviewed, and the interviewers have tried to embarrass me about my past or to make me feel that I should somehow, feel bad about all this work that I did on drugs and drug effects. And I don't see that at all. I mean, I think that my work has been a seamless evolution, and that without those decades that I worked in the area of ethnobotany and ethnopharmacology and looking at states of consciousness and drugs, I don't think I would have been able to come to the conclusions that I have about health and healing that are really the basis of my work in integrative medicine today.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, that question I asked you came in part from Dustin Sulak, but here's another one from Derek Snyder, which I'm also very curious about. Now, following up exactly with what you just said, when we think specifically of psychedelics, entheogens, how about those? I mean, you've talked pretty openly about your own exploration, experimentation with those, you know, over, especially when you were younger in South America and North America. How has that contributed to your understanding of mind-body healing?
Totally. I mean, I think that without those psychedelic experiences, I don't think I would really see the world the way I do today. You know, that in those experiences, I had really first-hand demonstrations to me of the fact that the state of one's mind really determines the state of external reality. You know, one obvious example of that is that the way a dog behaves toward you has to do with your attitude toward it, that if you're fearful of the dog, it will behave in an aggressive manner. And but I think, you know, on a much larger scale than that, that external reality is in some way involved with, a product of, influenced by internal reality. And I don't think I would have ever seen that clearly if I had not had those psychedelic experiences, and that has very much influenced my thinking about how the mind affects the body in health and disease.
Yeah, you know, I'm wondering also about when we look back at some of the major figures in the evolution, and you've had different relationships with them. You know, if we think about, say, Norman Zinberg and Schultes, and then about Timothy Leary and Richard Alpert, now Ram Dass. If you think about those four, I mean, you've had very different relationships with all of them. What would you? I mean, just offer us a little bit on each one of those.
Well, Dick Schultes was my main academic mentor, and really opened the world of ethnobotany and plant science, as well as Latin American culture and Native American culture to me. So, you know, I'm very grateful to him. I mean, that was, I think, the wisest thing I did in my academic career was become a botany major and affiliate with him. And I think that has been enormously valuable to me in my medical career, because it's given me a knowledge of and experience of the natural world that most physicians don't have, and that's totally influenced my thinking about how to treat the body. Norman Zinberg was a very close friend and mentor, without him I would not have been able to do the drug research that I did. I think he particularly made me aware of the concept of set and setting, and how much expectation and environment modifies pharmacology, and that also, you know, really was another stream that fed into the way that I look at the body and the mind in relation to the external world. Alpert and Leary, when I was an undergraduate at Harvard, they were doing their experiments. You know, I would say that now Ram Dass, is a friend and colleague and associate and somebody who I think really opened the world of Eastern religion to me, and helped me see that the Eastern tradition, through meditation, for example, through seeking all older states of consciousness and non-drug methods, was another route to these same experiences. So he's somebody who I'm most interested in, and especially now that my main focus has been writing about healthy aging, you know, this is right in line with what he's been doing as well. And I think he is himself an interesting example of aging and acceptance of changing that aging brings in a very inspiring way. Tim Leary, you know, I can't say that... I think aside from the fact that I was very attracted to and interested in what he was doing back in the 1960s, I don't think I had the kind of relationship with him that really influenced my thinking or ways of, you know, of moving through the world in the way that the other three have.
Yeah, are there others who really stood out for you as kind of intellectual, either mentors or people whose writing and thinking shaped your thinking in big ways on this?
Well, you know, there was a Lakota medicine man, Leonard Crowdog, who really introduced me to Native American ceremonial work that was very influential. An osteopathic physician, Robert Fulford, who directly got me interested in the mind-body connection, and which I'd say led me to the work of John Sarno that I was able to turn you on to when you had your episode of back pain. But I think, you know, I can't really think of too many others, and I think a lot of my my education, a lot of the ways that I've come to see things really have been as a result of looking inward in myself, mm-hmm. and finding, you know, really trusting my own intuition and finding those sources of information that are inside me.
Okay, well, let me finish what will probably be maybe the two toughest questions, okay? You know, you'll remember back about, 15 years or so ago, maybe a little less, when I was still teaching at Princeton, I pulled together this working group, right, the Princeton Working Group on the Future of Drug Use and Alternatives to Drug Prohibition. And you were in it, and we had, a lot of leading drug experts, Marsha Rosenbaum and Craig Reinerman, Harry Levine, Lynn Zimmer, John Morgan, Jeff Fagan. We had Sylvia Law and Ken Warner. We had Sasha Shulgin and Mike Aldrich, Paul Goldstein, just a lot of very, very smart people struggling with what's the best way, the optimal way to deal with drugs and drug, you know, in this society. And nobody in the group was an out-and-out libertarian, so nobody was arguing for total legalization. On the other hand, everybody was critical of the drug war, and we had the toughest time figuring out what would be the optimal policy. And I remember there was a point in the third session where we came to this vote, which was basically the $64,000 question of the legalization debate. Which is, do you believe that there should be some sort of legally sanctioned gatekeeper, a cop, a doctor, a pharmacist, what have you, between the provider of a drug and the consumer, the adult consumer? And in the end, the group split down the middle. And we debated again, and then the group split down the middle again, but they had switched sides. I mean, people were kept struggling. And I wonder, you know, where you are now, we think about how should we deal with these things. More information is pivotal. But what do you think about this issue of gatekeepers and their role to the state?
You know, I think that when you look at the psychedelics, that in the native cultures, the shamans are the gatekeepers. And I think that works very well. When you look at stimulants and depressants, I don't think gatekeepers are necessary. I think rather what you want are good role models, you know, and ideally that would be parents or teachers, that is people who can model good behavior around drugs for young people. But I wouldn't call them gatekeepers. Mm-hmm. So, you know, in an ideal world, I think drugs would be freely available. People would be educated about their use. And there would be models of acceptable and desirable behavior around them.
Okay, well, that's a good answer. Now, here's the last question, and it's a tough one also, which is that, you know, we are used to, we almost all repeat the mantra about kids, teenagers, don't do drugs. You're best off don't doing drugs. I think you say it at the beginning of Chocolate to Morphine, and we say it in our Safety First stuff. The best way to avoid a problem with drugs is don't use it in the first place. So we've been pretty clear about that. Now, on the other hand, just to play devil's advocate here, there are some, including this includes Rick Doblin at the MAPS, Multidisciplinary Association of Psychedelic Studies, who really has been playing a pivotal role in our society today in helping facilitate research into psychedelics and marijuana, who are saying, look, let's be a little more honest about this. In point of fact, many of us, although we're fully aware of how devastating drug addiction and drug abuse can be, you know, on the other hand, who can deny that many of us have benefited from these experiences? And that includes benefits that we experienced, maybe not when we were 12, but benefits we experienced in our teens and late teens and early 20s. And so it raises this question, you know, is there ever a time or way in which one would say that using drugs, especially perhaps the psychedelics or cannabis, might be something that one would recommend even to a person under the age of 18 or 21?
Well, I have known a number of people who have introduced their kids to these drugs as coming-of-age rituals when they turn 13 or 16 or 18 and have been very pleased with the results of that. So I think that's a personal decision. I think for many people growing up in this culture, experimenting with drugs is a normal part of adolescence. It's you know, analogous to experimenting with sex. It's something that's in the world that you want to have knowledge of, and I think it's a part of life. You know, my concern is that if drugs are thrown into the mix too early, they may, you know, interfere with normal growth and development or make it harder for kids to come to terms with all the things that are going on in adolescence. But I certainly think there are potential benefits for some people, and I think we have to be honest about that side of drugs as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm just going to say this to everybody who's been listening to this web chat for the last hour. It's been a pleasure and honor for me to have my old friend Andy Weil on this chat. You know, his three books, Natural Mind, Chocolate to Morphine, and The Marriage of the Sun and the Moon have been updated, revised, and reissued, and you can buy them either anywhere on the website, but of course by also going to the Drug Policy Alliance website. And he's got a new book on healthy aging coming out later on this year. I will be traveling around the country. But let me also say this, that to the extent that you agree with what Andy has been saying about drugs, you know, there are more and more organizations and people fighting for a more rational and sane and compassionate drug policy in this country and around the world. The Drug Policy Alliance is the leading organization in the country, if not the world, really fighting to change laws and policies and attitudes so that they're more consistent, really, with many of the things that Andy has been writing about and speaking about for more than 30 years. So please, if you're not yet a member, a supporter of the Drug Policy Alliance, please go to the homepage and sign up. Please offer what you can. And Andy, to you, I am so indebted. Thank you so much for doing this. I really love you, man, and I think you're doing an amazing job.
And, you know, I second all those things you said about the Drug Policy Institute, and that's why I am a member, and I recommend it highly.
Okay, Andy, thanks so much.
Okay, bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.